Let's go to Rogerio's case.
So this is a 69-year-old Hispanic female, previous smoker, quit 20 years before the diagnosis, mild hypertension, well controlled on one drug only, who presented with a cough that wouldn't go away and progressive dyspnea on exertion, no hemoptysis, and mild anorexia, and had lost about 6 pounds in the preceding 2 months, which is less than 5% of her baseline weight. Significant right-sided pleural effusion with probable some collapse of the right lower lobe as well. Had a positive cytology for adenocarcinoma on the thoracentesis. CT scan confirming what the chest x-ray had suggested, the fluid plus the collapsed lung. The chest tube followed by pleurodesis with complete re-expansion of the right lung. And once we saw the CT, she had multiple pulmonary nodules, as you can appreciate. PET scan negative outside the chest, MRI of the brain negative, so stage 4 non-small cell lung cancer, adenocarcinoma, performance status 1.
So before you go on to what happened, just real quick, a couple people or maybe respond how you think you might react to this case, Mark?
I mean, sounds like it's the same considerations that Tom put up for Mr. Walsh, that you might generate the same list of options.
But without the comorbidities.
Well, yeah, exactly. So this becomes even a bit more complex because this patient would probably be a great patient for all of the possibilities, but you can only choose one. And again, I think we're evolving in with the Avastin data, the Flex data, and then the pemetrexed data. Now I kind of think is what's the optimal chemotherapy and what's the optimal targeted agent to put with the chemotherapy? And I think that's where we are in lung cancer, which, again, I don't know that we have clarity. We've talked about biomarkers or selection features for anti-VEGF therapy. But it's refreshing to have all these options for patients, and we've got to figure out what the best option are for patients like this.
So this woman says to you, doc, come on, tell me, what's your first choice? What's your recommendation?
Again, I'm used and kind of gotten into selecting patients who were bevacizumab eligible. This patient said, that's what I've been doing. I haven't evolved into the substituting out cetuximab. We don't obviously have comparative data. But I think for patients who, if she had some issue that made bevacizumab not an attractive agent, obviously, you have another targeted agent that may benefit.
Which chemo, though?
Which chemo for this patient? Again, I go back to I'm influenced by the pemetrexed data. I'm not yet convinced that it's important that an adenocarcinoma get pemetrexed first line. They have to get pemetrexed at some point. They can get it first line. We don't have any phase 3 data yet first line, but a study is planned looking at that in this population.
Ed, how would you think of the
I think even with this person, I still go, as Mark was saying, with a platinum-based doublet with bevacizumab. But the cetuximab stuff is coming in, and it's, you know.
Vince?
I will give you my bottom line first, because I know that's part of what we want. I would give a platinum, pemetrexed, and bevacizumab in this patient. Just liking that at the worst, the pemetrexed's a wash, and certainly the lady will be happy she's not losing that much hair. That being said, you know, one of the things we do when we talk about this tissue matter is we throw away 95% of the pleural fluid we get. You know, you can get many more cells from this, make a cell block and get the test Paul talked about, and no compelling reason that this lady needs to start treatment tomorrow. She has pleurodesis done. She's got multiple pulmonary nodules. If you believed in the biomarkers driving your treatment, you would have time to get some of those results.
Absolutely.
It just begs a quick question about a procedure and giving Bev right away. You know,
right.
Did that give any of you any pause?
After a chest tube?
Well, I mean, even chest tube and pleurodesis. Wouldn't you give Bev right away
within
2 weeks
week,
later?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So you put
is that wrong, David?
No, I think it's fine. I mean, for any small procedures, I'm just curious, but a lot of people are uncomfortable.
You're using a week?
Well, actually, for porticath.
That's what everybody's been talking about, porticath.
We're using 2 weeks.
2 weeks now. I've heard anybody use 1 week? 2 weeks?
For
none?
Ports, we use 1 week.
1 week, yes. Right. Porticath. Okay. So I thought it was interesting what happened to this patient.
Uh-oh.
So she was actually treated on 4599.
She was actually on the protocol?
Yeah. Had a good partial response to 6 cycles of the combination and then went on to receive maintenance bevacizumab for 4 additional months. And then at that point, she developed bone pain, sort of diffuse, couldn't really localize, plus fatigue and lack of appetite. And her bone scan, it's pretty impressive. Multiple foci of uptake within her skeleton and an increase in the size and number of her pulmonary nodules. MRI of the brain negative again. By that point, she had dropped her performance status to 2 and she was open to participating in clinical trials or receiving standard management.
So real quick, let's go around the table, get a couple of inputs in terms of if this patient were presenting today at your place, what kind of trial might she participate in? What kind of off-protocol therapy would you be thinking about? Tony?
In relapse, we have a trial now with actually pemetrexate, as long as she didn't get it first line, and an oral angiogenesis inhibitor, which might be interesting for her since she already responded initially.
Oral anti-angiogen, what exactly is it?
It's AZD2171.
Interesting. So again, getting back to this patient in relapse, Mark, what would you be thinking about for her at your place, one study and off?
Yeah, I mean, I think off study, her two options are pemetrexate or erlotinib. We have a study we just opened in CLGB, a randomized phase 2 trial comparing pemetrexate, sunitinib versus the combination of pemetrexate and sunitinib, a randomized phase 2 that's just open in CLGB. I would offer that trial to her at this point. Having prior Avastin doesn't exclude her from that trial. So
this is an adeno, right? This is an adenocarcinoma patient,
yes,
right?
Right.
Right.
Okay.
What about this issue of a patient who seems to have had a good response to Bev in terms of the TKIs? Does that kind of intuitively make sense that maybe they might respond better?
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think we need some data about these bevacizumab failures in terms of how they behave. Do they respond or what do they respond to? It seems logical to me that if you have sequestered VEGF ligand with bevacizumab, that the receptor signaling mechanism might still be stimulated by other proangiogenic factors, and a receptor-based approach might make more sense in these patients who have failed that. But we have no clinical data yet to address that.
Tom, we're hearing a lot in other tumors about the issue of continuation of biologics on progression, switching with chemo, and actually the most interesting is Bev in colon cancer. They had this paper that came out about it, I think a year ago, registry data suggesting that people kept the Bev going, did better. They now have a prospective trial in colon cancer, randomizing. Where do you think this is heading?
I think it's heading that I think it's likely we're going to find similar trends in lung cancer. There's no proof of it yet. In this patient, I wouldn't necessarily keep the Bev going. I know that there are docs in practice who are doing that at this point, and I think that they're not crazy because I think eventually, you know, the data will, I suspect, support that type of approach with Bev, but I think we need large trials to be able to show that in this setting. With this patient, I would either put them on pemetrexate alone or I put them on Mark's study.
Paul?
This patient is stage 4A. In fact, this patient's stage 4AA. There's a new staging classification for lung cancer that physicians in practice need to be aware of. People with multiple nodules and people with pleural effusions will be stage 4A. They do better than patients with stage 4B. So this patient in the new staging classification would be actually stage 4A for actually two reasons. They didn't address whether if you
if you're 4A squared, you become 4B.
4B. They didn't address that in the issue. I think this is a classic example of where I would have gotten the biomarkers, like Vince said, with the pleural effusion to begin with, because it would have affected my first treatment. In the absence of any data, you know, because we're quite convinced that erlotinib, pemetrexate, and docetaxel will give same survival second line, in the absence of any data, I would favor erlotinib for this patient in second line. However, if I knew she was KRAS positive and FISH negative, I'd be favoring pemetrexate in the second line. Okay, so, you know, I think the time to get the marker analysis is in the beginning when you've got the tissue.
It's interesting. But you were on a panel we had during ASCO, and I see in just a month the evolution of your thinking. Really fascinating. Let's find out with what happened to the patient. Rogerio, can you follow up?
She was treated with pemetrexate, and I continued the bevacizumab.
What happened?
She had stabilization of her disease for approximately 4 months and then progressed again. And then I switched her to erlotinib, this time without Bev, just erlotinib alone. And she never really responded and eventually passed away.
One final comment also, Wally, your perspective on this issue of what was actually done in this patient, which was to continue a biologic on progression. What are your thoughts about that?
I just don't know whether we have data. It's reasonable in that it was well tolerated and she had a reasonable run initially, but I just don't think we have data, but I'm sure we'll design a trial to show that.
Actually, I'm not sure we will design a trial to show that. I suspect it's going to be something that's going to be done based on derivative data from other tumor types and other trials, such as the beta trial, which looks at erlotinib plus or minus bevacizumab. But not exactly in the case of people who've had prior Bev. So I think it's going to be a tough question to ask.
Of course, and we'll probably have data for ASCO next year.
Yeah.
Tom, one of the things we've done in our patterns of care studies is not only ask people, well, what is your preferred choice, but how do you feel about other choices? So I want to know whether you see a patient like this and the first doc's recommended to continue the Bev, would you be okay with it, or you say no way?
As I said, I absolutely would be okay with it, and a lot of people do it, and I think they have good reason for it, and I think that it will turn out to be. I actually think that's how we'll be practicing in the future. I think continuing the Bev in Bev-eligible patients will eventually make sense. I think there's reason to believe that bevacizumab makes chemotherapy better. I don't know why it wouldn't make second-line chemotherapy better, and so I think what Ruggiero did here is something which I'm comfortable with. It's not what I'm doing right now off of a protocol, but I don't think it's crazy.
Ron?
And I think there is some concern about the rapid revascularization of tumors when one stops an anti-angiogenic factor. Certainly VEGF, once you've been sinking it with an antibody for months and months, to leave it unrestrained stimulus to vascularization could lead to more vigorous tumor growth and more active and rapid repopulation of metastatic sites. So I think there's two sides to the sword. I think continuing the anti-angiogenic treatment is important. We don't have enough data to prove that yet, but I think discontinuing it could also lead to some downstream problems.
And if we wanted to continue this seminar till midnight tonight, we could start to bring in the cost issues, but I think we'll stick with sort of the risk-benefit clinical issues. Mark, we usually don't get much consensus about this issue outside of this, and there are usually a few people who say, absolutely not, I don't think that's appropriate, you know, societal cost, individual cost, et cetera. What do you think?
If I see a second opinion where the doc's continuing it, I encourage them to stop, to be honest with you. That's the way the trial was designed. I understand all the theoretical concerns. I'm concerned about cost, toxicity, adding, you know, various, I've seen a number of different chemotherapies put together with bevacizumab. I just don't know what benefit the patient's getting. And I know there's an issue of continued risk in that setting. So I've been a bit more in favor of clearly stopping it at the time of progression.
I think it's important to bring out that there is heterogeneity in how people view this. In colon, it was interesting because up until last ASCO in the think tank we had right after it, everybody was absolutely, you should not do this, you know, a lot of concern about cost. And then they saw those bright registry data and amazingly, a lot of people changed their mind, but not all. Vince?
I was just going to add that Tom's point, I sort of agree with, we'll never see a trial that particularly addresses this, although I think the beta lung data, if positive, would probably be bastardized, so to speak, to draw that conclusion. The one drug that might answer this in part, although it could be a drug-specific thing, is the VEGF TRAP trial, because that's a phase 3 trial of TRAP plus docetaxel versus docetaxel, and patients with prior bevacizumab are eligible. And although you might invoke that it's molecule-specific, you would at least have some data, since the molecules, unless you work for one of the companies, are pretty similar, supporting that hypothesis.
Ed?
And I think what was touched on, and Ron brought this up a little bit with the biology and Paul with the staging, is there's progression and then there's progression. And in Ruggiero's patient, for instance, I mean, it was clear once that progression occurred, it was explosive. It was different biologically than when she first started. There was new disease everywhere. And so when I see a patient like that, even though I am one of these card-carrying people that does usually continue the Bev in most people to their second line, I wouldn't have in that case because I think that the tumor has just taken a turn and it's decided to do something different. So I would have gone with a single agent such as either docetaxel, PEM, or erlotinib.
I would just also add one other thing, which is the question of patient's preference for Bev compared to cetuximab. You know, we think of Bev, we worry about life-threatening hemorrhage and we think of death. We think of cetuximab, we think of rash, it's not so bad. If you're the patient and you haven't died from hemoptysis, you love your bevacizumab. It's well tolerated, you like getting it, you like the maintenance part of it, and you want to continue it when you're treating with chemotherapy. So I think the patients have a lot of input into this decision making and kind of influence what we do a lot in terms of the decision to continue.
I agree. I have a patient I'm treating now and the same thing. I started him with Bev-based chemotherapy up front. He progressed after a year and I started him on erlotinib with the Bev, and then he started having renal issues where his protein started creeping up. So he got up to 2,200 and we stopped, and then he got down to 1,800 after several months, and he emails me back and says, can I start now?
Right.
I said, no, wait.
Yeah, proteinuria doesn't hurt.
Right.
You know?
We see that a lot with the antibodies. I mean, you think about it, you know, rituximab and trastuzumab in terms of quality of life. Once these people start getting the treatment without the chemo,
yeah,
and they realize they feel you know, pretty good.
Well, that's the amazing thing about bevacizumab. All the small molecule VEGF TKIs, the fatigue is horrendous.
Yeah.
But bevacizumab is the one VEGF inhibitor that doesn't make unbelievable fatigue. I don't know why.
In some patients, I agree, you know, once they get on the bevacizumab alone, they seem to tolerate it very well. I've been asked by several patients, how long should I stay on it, and how much is staying on it really helping me? And do I have to come every 3 weeks and get it?
The next new data set discussed by the group was a randomized trial presented at ASCO in which patients with advanced disease were initially treated with 4 cycles of one of several different platinum doublets, and patients without progression were then randomized 2-to-1 to maintenance pemetrexed or best supportive care, and this showed that the maintenance pemetrexed resulted in improvement in progression-free survival and a non-significant increase in survival. Dr. Miller began the discussion.
To me, it has not changed my practice dramatically. I mean, for all the prior studies that have been done, depends on how one interprets them. I always thought that if clinical oncology could discern which patients were getting benefit from going beyond 4 to 6 cycles and which weren't, which patients could be followed closely for progression with scanning, and which ones really benefit from continued treatment. So it has not changed too much in what I do. I think one of the issues that comes up, again, is this issue of sort of extrapolation from across the data that will happen in routine practice, is that an individual will be started on a pemetrexed-based doublet with carbo or cisplatin, with or without bevacizumab. And the doc in practice, and maybe me at times, or I at times, will draw on data from this that I should continue that pemetrexed in maintenance or continue that pemetrexed and bevacizumab in maintenance. And that's going to be addressed in a phase 3 trial, but I think that's a very logical, perhaps pitfall or caveat for how not to interpret this data.
Mark, this is a good example of how oncologists get different messages in different tumors. In breast cancer, metastatic breast cancer, people just treat. When they progress, they put them on something else. In colon cancer, it's sort of like that, but then they have sort of the Optimox thing where they try to give patients holidays. You all have had this sort of fixed number of cycles. Now these new data came out. What's the algorithm you're working with?
Yeah, I think when most of us trained, at least when I trained, I was taught that lung cancer, metastatic lung cancer, was a one-and-done disease. You got platinum-based therapy, and that was it. And it's transitioned into what I like to call managing lung cancers, like pitching in baseball. You got to get 3 strikes into this patient. We have 3 lines of approved therapy, and I think what Paul Bunn's point is that I think we're looking at just more patients getting active agents and getting exposure to them, and so you're seeing better progression-free and overall survival as a result of getting, you know, 2 or 3 lines of therapy. So my thinking has been, when I see a patient for the first time, you have your first-line decision, but I always say to patients that my goal is that over time, you're going to get exposure to 2 or 3 lines of therapy rather than just a single line of treatment.
Well, one thing that's unusual about this algorithm is you're switching the therapy when the patient hasn't progressed. I mean, you can look at it that way. So is that something that you're doing in your practice?
No, I mean, I think I agree with Vince. I think that this data hasn't necessarily, you know, because of my 3-strike theory in my positioning to try to get exposure to second, third line therapy. I follow the patients pretty closely. As Paul said, you see them every 4 to 6 weeks. You're ready to intervene before they become too symptomatic, before their disease becomes overwhelming, and you get them treated where they still have a good performance status. So this data hasn't really changed how I practice, although how I was practicing was really with the goal of getting these therapies in.
Paul?
Yeah, I think that's the critical element. It used to be you'd give a platinum doublet and go to Europe and enjoy yourself and, you know, forget about it. Now we have multiple agents that improve survival. I agree with Mark. So you need to continue to follow the patient closely. I think there's 2 errors that occur sometimes in practice. One is you don't follow the patient closely enough after the platinum doublet. And so in my practice, I continue to get a CT scan every 6 weeks. But I actually continue to see the patient every 3 weeks to see symptomatically how they're doing. So I think if you do that and you begin your next line of treatment, as soon as there's some either symptomatic worsening or a suggestion of progression on the scan, you will be able to get the 3rd line in. Another thing is patients, when I first see them, I evaluate them every cycle. If people are getting worse on their 1st cycle of treatment, there's no reason to continue that treatment. you go to strike two, you know, sometime sooner. The last point I would make is that people who respond to their initial treatment, and that response lasts more than 6 weeks, we often forget that the first treatment worked. Okay, so people will get a taxane first line, have a great response. You know, later they get pemetrexed and erlotinib. You know, that's appropriate. But remember, they responded to their taxane in the beginning. So people who respond and have a long progression-free survival, it's not so bad to, at some point, reinstitute the treatment that helped them in the beginning.
Speaking of taxanes, Mark, you know, there's a lot of interest and excitement in nab-paclitaxel and breast cancer, but I don't get a lot of that out of you all in terms of lung cancer. It's been looked at your place. What are your thoughts about where it might be heading, both in terms of the question of could it provide increased anti-tumor effect, do the benefits in terms of lack of premedication, et cetera,
make a
difference practically in these patients?
Well, I think the lack of premedication and ease of administration enhances some practicality aspects of the drug. Is it a better drug, I think, is the central question. And there's a phase 3 trial that's just started. I don't quite know how many patients are on it yet, comparing carboplatin with carboplatin. So I think that until we know the results of that trial, I don't know that there's been a lot of enthusiasm for using it. It's quite more expensive than generic Taxol. So I think that's been an issue.
Yeah, that always comes up. And usually ask breast cancer docs, if NAB were the same cost reimbursement, would you use it or Gramophore? Most people say, yeah, sure, we do it.
And like in my practice, I mean, 10 years ago, pretty much all I did was carboplatin. Now I'm doing a lot more Carbogem and Carbolimta, and all these other agents are available. So the taxanes have kind of become a bit less prominent in my practice.
Vince?
I just make the point as part of an auto critique and co-author on that paper that when we studied docetaxel, you know, 12 years ago, Ron identified our patients as Olympic athletes because we had a 38% response rate and a 9-month median survival at a time we didn't have second, third, and fourth line treatment. So I think the jury's out on whether this imparts better efficacy, at least in some subset of patients.